Okay, so I want to start by reminding you of what we had calculated last time, the results. We obtained the recursion relations for this RU model or 5/4 model or whatever you want to call it. And the recursion relations that we got were R in the L plus 1th iteration is 4 times R in the L iteration plus 3CUL over 1 plus RL. And U, 2 to the epsilon. UL minus 4 minus D. And these recursion relations have two fixed points. One is the Gaussian fixed point. Which is R equals U equals 0. And we'll call that G. And the second fixed point is what we call the non-trivial fixed point, which is R star. Oh, just a second, I should have. Yes, let's call this star. Fixed point. R star is minus 4 epsilon log 2 over 9. And U star is equal to epsilon log 2 over 9C. These are both correct to order epsilon. And so we can start drawing the flow diagram. G and T, and that's what this says. And I also wanted to give you a reference, another reference, which I guess I've sort of mentioned. Which is a paper entitled Critical Exponents in 3.99 dimensions. And that's Fizeroff Letters, volume 28, page 240, 1972. I may have said the wrong thing yesterday. I might have said something about 2.99 dimensions, which was just a mistake. I actually tried Googling this paper in 2.99 dimensions, and I couldn't find it because I was in the wrong dimension. But that's what it is, 4 minus d. And that paper actually is a very nice summary of what we're doing, unlike the Wilson and Kogut paper, which is an enormous elaboration of what we're doing. Typical Fizeroff letter fashion. Okay. So we have this flow diagram, we need to analyze the flow. I mean, we just have these fixed points. There's no flow. I haven't drawn in how coupling constants renormalize. So we want to analyze the flow. And so just for fun, let's start with the Gaussian fixed point. So near the Gaussian fixed point, we have some recursion relations, which we can write something like this. But of course, R star and U star are zero, so that simplifies things a little bit. And we represent this as TRR R plus TRU U in the notation we introduced some time ago. And then there's another equation called et cetera. And so for this fixed point, T, R, R. OK, so now we look at these recursion relations. And we see that T, R, R is 4. T, R, U is 12C. T, U, R is 0, and TUU is 2 to the epsilon. So there's your 2 to the epsilon. You differentiate this equation with respect to U. You differentiate this expression with respect to R, so that would be DU DR. Yeah, well, you know, there's a little bit of R over here, but there's a U squared up in the numerator, and U's already epsilon, so forget about that. So that's why you get 0, and so forth, similar reasoning. If you think of this as a matrix, 4, 12c, 0, 2 to the epsilon, then it's pretty obvious that the eigenvalues are what are they? What are the eigenvalues of that matrix? Come on, you said it. What?
Minus 4 minus 2 thirds.
Yeah, because this doesn't matter. Okay. So they're both larger than 1 if epsilon is greater than 0. So what about the flow? So in other words, if you start at one place near the Gaussian fixed point, where do you go? Is there a problem here? No? Okay. So let's say initially it's something along the R axis. Then T operating on RU looks like this, 4, 12C, 0, 2 to the epsilon, x0, which is equal to 4, x0. So basically, this is basically saying that R prime 0 is 4 R0. So basically, if you start out at some point on the R axis, you flow away from 0 by a factor of 4. Okay. Now, what's the other orthogonal? Well, it's not orthogonal. So what happens if, now here, if you do a calculation, you can see that, so this corresponds to eigenvector 4. What's the eigenvector, this corresponds to eigenvalue 4, this eigenvector here. What's the eigenvector that corresponds to eigenvalue 2 to the epsilon? That's the next question you want to ask. Okay. So I'll just write it down. So if it's something along this direction, where x is just some number that you can pick to be whatever you want, presumably small. And I had to do a calculation to get this. So I won't do the calculation of the eigenvector. I will simply show you that it's the eigenvector. So then TRU is equal to 4, 12c, 0, 2 to the epsilon, times this, minus 12cx over 4 minus 2 to the epsilon, x. And that's equal to, that's this times that. I'm going to put everything over a common denominator of 4 minus 2 to the epsilon. Plus 12cx. Oh, let's not do that. And then down here, you've just got 2 to the epsilon x. And then this is, then if you put it over a common denominator, what do you got here? You've got minus 48cx plus 12 plus 48cx. Minus 2 to the epsilon 12cx over 4 minus 2 to the epsilon. And down here, you still got 2 to the epsilon. So these disappear. And basically, yeah, you've got what you started with. 2 to the epsilon times minus 12 cx. Over 4 minus 2 to the epsilon x. Okay, I did all that right. Yeah. So now, what does this tell us? This tells us that, going back to our flow diagram, the first result up here says that if you start out on the r direction, you flow like that. And the second result down here says that if you start off in this direction, then you get multiplied by a factor of 2 to the epsilon. So this direction here is r negative, u positive. Like that. Okay. Was any, yes, Nicole?
Are we making an assumption about the value of D?
D. Oh, yeah. I'm assuming that epsilon is positive. Yeah. So D is less than 4. That's right. What happens when D is 4 to this picture? So 2 to the epsilon is 1. But what happens to the fixed points? See, where are those fixed points? There they are. What happens to the two fixed points when epsilon is 0? They're both on top of each other, right? And what else can we say about this? Oh, I see, yeah. No, that's okay. That's just 3 minus. Anyway, okay. So this one comes down to here.
Can we say that when we move in this direction, we just stay where we are? If epsilon is 0.
Well, then it's a fixed point. It's definitely a fixed point. Yeah, you just stay there. Yeah, but the question is, what happens if you're a little bit away? You know, we know that you go that way for the Gaussian model.
Yeah, but for if epsilon is 0, if I study the other direction, then I will get that I stay where I
stay there, right. Yeah. It stays Gaussian in that sense. Yeah. Okay. So now the last thing we need to do is calculate the exponents at the non-trivial fixed point. So we're going to linearize the recursion relations around the non-trivial fixed point, and then basically what we find there is that this matrix T is equal to 4 minus 12 CU star over 1 plus R star squared C over 1 plus R star 2 to the epsilon times 18 CU star squared over 1 plus R star squared. I'm writing all this out, so it's really sort of superfluous. And 2 to the epsilon times 1 minus 18 CU star over 1 plus R star squared. Yeah. And if you go through these terms and you look, so let's see, so I have a note in my notes saying that if you look at this and you note that U star is equal to epsilon log 2 over 9 C, that's what U star is, presumably up there somewhere. Yeah, you can see it. And so when you put that in here, this thing here turns into minus 2 epsilon log 2 because the 9 C's cancel and then that's it. Okay. And then that's already of order epsilon, so the R stars, which are of order of epsilon, you can forget about down here. Okay. And so basically, to make a long story short, what have we got here? You do the same trick here. You have 4 minus 4 thirds epsilon log 2 from here, doing the same type of calculation. You've got 12C up here. Down here you've got 0 because, well, it's the old thing. You've got U star squared up in the numerator. That's epsilon squared. And then down here, we just calculated it. You get 1 minus epsilon log 2. And so the eigenvalues, so is everybody comfortable with that? 0 because of U star squared, minus 1 minus epsilon log 2 because of this argument. The denominator is irrelevant. The prefactor is irrelevant because it's of order of 1. We correct the epsilon correction. We give you a higher order correction.
No,
that's not right. Yeah, OK, so what have I got here? You're right, yes. So what do we have? We have 2 to the epsilon, which is 2 to the, is e to the epsilon log 2, which is 1 plus epsilon log 2 times this thing here, which is 1 minus 2 epsilon log 2. And so that's equal to 1 minus epsilon log 2. Okay, sorry about that. Okay. So that's how we get this. Okay, so the eigenvalues then of this matrix, again, because you've got the zero down here, so the eigenvalues four minus 4/3 epsilon log 2. And as long as epsilon isn't too large, that is relevant. Okay, so it's bigger than 1. And then the other one, however, is manifestly irrelevant unless epsilon is 0. And so that means that around the non-trivial fixed point, when you start along some direction, which is the eigenvector corresponding to this eigenvalue, then you flow closer to the fixed point. That's what irrelevant means. It means that the distance from the fixed point is going to flow to 0. So at this point, without doing the calculation of the actual eigenvectors, let's just connect the dots. Okay? And so basically what's happening here is that you flow there. With the irrelevant operator, and you flow away with the relevant operator. So that's the effect of turning on epsilon. You move this point up to here, a distance from the Gaussian fixed point, which is of order epsilon. And it's also important, as I think I was commenting in the last lecture, that it moves towards negative r. And so what this means is that imagine that your starting Hamiltonian has some value of u, which is positive, and it better be positive, because if it's negative, the whole system's unstable. So so there's some u naught. That means that you're starting here. Somewhere along this line, depending on the value of r. And this is your critical surface. This line that connects the Gaussian point to the non-trivial fixed point. And so what that means is that if you start out up here at some larger r, you flow like this. If your starting r is in this region or over here. But if your starting r is over here on this side, you flow like that. So your critical r, the critical point for this Hamiltonian that starts out with u naught, is right here at some r value, which is negative. Okay? So this is a little bit like saying that the In mean field theory, you would start out at the mean field transition. Your transition would occur at the mean field transition temperature, which would be R equals zero. But the effect of this U and calculating properly the effect of thermal fluctuations, basically what it means is that the transition occurs at a lower temperature than the mean field temperature. Okay? And also, of course, it means that its exponents will be controlled by this point rather than by this point. Okay, this is Gaussian point. The exponents that it has are mean field-like. But this one will have different exponents. Okay, and so that's what this picture is telling you. So now let's go on and calculate the exponents. Yes, yes.
Sorry, can you clarify which is the critical surface again?
The one that the yellow line touches.
No, it's quite faint.
Sorry, yeah, let's go see if I can get this thing down again.
So is the light here?
It's the line defined by, it's the line where the flow takes you from here to the non-trivial fixed point. And it divides all of the flows on this side, which flow to large R from the points on this side, the flows on this side that flow to large negative R. So that's the important thing. You know, TC, the temperature at which the transition occurs, is a property of a model. It depends on the parameters of the model. It's not, in that sense, universal, okay, in the sense that exponents that are controlled by the non-trivial fixed point that you flow to or away from, they're universal. It doesn't matter what your starting Hamiltonian is. As long as it's controlled by that fixed point, you're going to get the same exponent. Okay, but TC itself, if you think in terms of this model in some dimension epsilon, which is presumably small, TC could be anywhere along the critical surface depending on what the U naught is for the starting Hamiltonian. Okay, so there's many different models that are modeled by this flow diagram. Yeah.
Does this mean that the correlation length also diverges
everywhere on the critical surface? Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Yeah, it's a little bit more complicated than the one-dimensional case, but basically, yeah. If you're on that line, it takes you, I guess, well, let's see. Anyway, it's infinite on that line, on the critical surface. Okay, so now we want to calculate the actual exponents. And so the thermal exponent... Y sub t is defined by lambda 1 equals b to the y sub t, where b for our problem is 2. So lambda 1 is equal to 4 minus 4/3 epsilon log 2, and that's equal to 2 to the y sub t. So when you work that out, so y sub t log 2 is equal to the log of 4 plus the log of 1 minus epsilon over 3 log 2. And this is 2 log 2. And this is minus epsilon over 3 log 2. And so y sub t is equal to 2 minus epsilon over 3. And that is 1 over nu, the correlation length exponent. And that means that nu is 1 over 2 minus epsilon over 3, which is equal to 1 over 2 times 1 minus epsilon over 6, which is equal to a half times 1 plus epsilon over 6. Which is equal to a half plus epsilon over 12. Good. Yeah?
Why are we using, in particular, one of the eigenvalues of the matrix that determines how R changes near G? How does that connect to YT?
That's the thermal exponent. That's
the
one.
Near the gas?
No. This is near the, this is the one from the other fixed point, from the non-trivial fixed point.
It's
right. It's
something we don't
blackboard
on the
right. Yeah. Okay. Okay, so that's nu. And then alpha is 2 minus d nu, which is equal to 2 minus. What's d? 4 minus epsilon times 1 half plus epsilon over 12. And that's epsilon over 6. Okay, and at this level, which is of order epsilon, eta is 0. Eta is but we won't calculate that. And so gamma, the susceptibility exponent, which is nu times 2 minus eta, is equal to 1 plus epsilon over 3. Have I got that right? No. 6.
Do you mind helping us parse where some of these came from? If we
Which?
Don't all
what?
Remember all the power laws explicitly.
Well, I wrote them. Sorry, which you mean what they mean? The nu, eta, epsilon, what they mean, or what?
Perhaps just a brief reminder of why they have those relationships among themselves?
Oh, no, that's in your notes.
Okay.
Sorry. That's the derivations that we did using the scaling relations that gave you the relations between alpha. This was hyperscaling. This came right out of the fact that the susceptibility is related to the integral of the correlation function. So these are all things that we did back in week one. Okay, but you've got them tabulated in your right next to the derivation. Okay, so Okay, so at this point, we're not going to calculate anymore because if you thought these calculations were lengthy, believe me, anything further would be much lengthier. And so I just want to tell you some results. Okay. So higher order And when people do these calculations, instead of just working with Ising-like variables where your sigmas are scalars, they tend to work with vector order parameters, which are m component vectors. Okay, so your sigma q would have m components, or n components, sorry. And actually, you can find these results in a paper. Probably the easiest place to find it, I've noticed as I was preparing this lecture, is on, there's a paper by Xin Justin on in Scholarpedia. It's also published in some journal, but you just go and look at the higher order results for the epsilon expansion. And so this is, and there's some numbers attached to it, but I think that's enough to get you there. And so, for instance, a result for gamma would look something like this. So the point here is that n equals 1 is the Ising model. N equals 2 might correspond to, will correspond to a two-component spin, just like the XY model that you're studying in your tutorial. And n equals 3 would correspond to a spin that could point anywhere on a three-dimensional space, the so-called Heisenberg model. Okay, and people do these calculations for general n. Actually, n equals 0 is an interesting case, which I leave it to you to explore. but the point that I would make is that this has been calculated to order epsilon to the fifth. I didn't even bother looking at the higher order terms because I wouldn't have had the energy to write them down. And so basically, if you think of gamma, for instance, if you call this gamma of n, so if you do the epsilon to the zero calculation, you get 1 for gamma. That's just the mean field result. If you go to first order, in epsilon, okay, so this is all for the three-dimensional Ising model, one component. So this is what you get from mean field theory. This is what you get to order epsilon, which is 1 plus a sixth. So that's 1.666. If you calculate the next order term, you get 1.2438. So this is epsilon to the 1, epsilon to the 2. If you calculate the next order term, you get 1.1948. That's epsilon to the 3. Epsilon to the fourth term, fourth sums to 1.3384. And epsilon to the fifth is what? 0.8918. Okay. Yes?
How is it possible it can expand the epsilon expansion to extend it to epsilon equals to 1? I mean, say, in the original case, you take the epsilon to be a small number and do the expansion.
Right.
And now you calculate and take epsilon just to 1.
Yeah, so what you're saying is that this doesn't seem like a good expansion parameter.
I think it does not make some physical sense to me.
Because you don't think epsilon equals 1 is a
because originally you do the expansion and take the epsilon to be a small number.
Right.
And say then that this kind of result should be only valid in some kind of 3.99 dimension. And now you just extend the result to say 3-dimensional.
Yeah, exactly.
So how is it possible?
It's possible because theorists are incredibly resourceful and they will apply all of the tools of higher mathematics to getting the maximum benefit out of the effort that they exert to calculate these things. Okay? So I mean, when you look at this, you might say, gee, that's not a very good, I mean, so this is the sum of the, you know, so this is the mean field, this is the sum of 1 plus the first order, this is the sum of 1 up to epsilon squared, and so forth, and it doesn't look very good. You might not have any idea what value of gamma this will go to if you calculate up to epsilon equals 20 or something like that. Okay. On the other hand, I guess, isn't it true, for instance, that if you do an expansion of e to the x, okay, what is that? 1 plus x plus x squared over 2 plus x cubed over 6 plus x fourth over what 24, whatever. And you do that and then stick in x equals 1. It's not so hard to get a good result.
The case is, for the EX, the convergent radiance is infinity.
Exactly, yes.
For this one, it's not.
It's not. Clearly, it's not. Right, okay. So basically, if you want to use these numbers to get anything that has physical meaning, well, I mean, there's a little bit of physical meaning there, but to get anything that has physical meaning, you need to extend the radius of convergence. You need to use some mathematical trick to extend the radius of convergence so that it includes epsilon equals 1. Okay? Yeah.
I'm sorry, but why is it obvious that the radius of convergence would be less than 1 here? I mean, okay,
well,
I can see that the result is not very good. But.
Yeah, okay, so maybe it's not obvious, but you might worry, okay?
Yeah.
I mean, if you had done the fifth order calculation at that point, you
But
might.
I wouldn't take it for granted that it doesn't converge either.
It's true. It might not. But the point is that having done this fifth order calculation, you would know what it would take you to do the sixth mm-hmm. order calculation. And you might think, oh, never going to happen. Okay. So there are techniques which I didn't come prepared to explain. So there is a technique called Borel summation. Which allows you to take the coefficients in a poorly converging series and do a transformation and represent the function in such a way that it does extend the radius of convergence. And I suggest that if you want, I mean, it's a good thing to know. Actually, did Carl Bender teach Borel summation? Or? Probably not. Yeah, we used to have this mathematical method, which is basically how to sum divergent series. But yeah, so he didn't do that. But it turns out that this is a good technique for this problem. And these guys, in Justin and his collaborators, did that kind of stuff. And so maybe time to move over here. Okay, so apparently you can estimate the error or uncertainty in your result when you do this Borel summation technique, and you get a number like that from the fifth order epsilon expansion. I have to say this reminds me of a paper by Dan Kleppner on measuring the fine structure constant, which, as you all know, is a fundamental constant, dimensionless fundamental constant of nature, which has been measured over the decades repeatedly with better and better techniques. And one of the observations that he makes in this paper is that every time that the method is improved by an order of magnitude in accuracy, the old result is at least two standard deviations outside the new result. So if you like, people always underestimate, or often, I should say, often underestimate their errors. Now, I'm sure that that doesn't apply to this case here, because these guys are serious mathematicians, and they wouldn't make mistakes in estimating their error. Okay, so it turns out that there's another way of calculating gamma, which is a perturbation which is a direct perturbation calculation of gamma in D equals 3. So this is not depending on epsilon being small. And this is based on the Callan-Simancic equations, which I must say you'll have to learn about in another course. I'm sure you will. And actually, the last calculation was done by a Canadian, actually probably in the same institute that you're in, the Guelph-Waterloo Physics Institute, Bernie Nickel at Guelph, is the master of these kinds of calculations. This is done years ago, of course. And what he found was so let's see, that's 41 difference by 41. Yeah, actually, I guess it's the same thing. If you go off this by two standard deviations, you don't get to this. But if you add the 005, yeah, okay, no, these have overlapping error bars, for sure. They're fine. I mean, these guys made their error bars big enough to overlap this result. Yes, they did. Okay. So it's good. Good people. Okay, so the bottom line is that people feel that they know how to calculate these exponents, and even the epsilon expansion allows you to do that. The calculation that we've done is the tiniest baby step in the direction of actually calculating them. But the basic idea is contained in what we presented. So I think that's more or less it for the epsilon expansion, although we'll use it. Yes?
Can I quickly ask something? Just to clarify, I guess that when we make calculations in higher orders in epsilon, that means we also do higher loop expansions, right?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, okay.
Oh, yeah.
And one other thing. We said that eta is zero here. I guess you have to calculate the correlation function.
That's
out
right.
There.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, it's actually, I think it's even in our book. Brooks and I wrote, but he wrote that part.
Okay.
It's in there. Mm-hmm. How to calculate the epsilon squared term. Okay. So let's go on a little bit. So in a sense, we're done with RG, and everything that I'm going to talk about for the rest of the course is going to have to do with scaling and scaling functions. But you know, if you understand the RG, you understand where they came from and why you should believe these types of arguments. So the next topic that I'd like to discuss is called corrections to scaling. And the reference here is Wegner in FISREV B, volume 5, 4529, 1972. And there are actually later references, but I think what I found was in terms of deriving what this means, that this one was fine. There's later work by Aharoni and Ahlers, who's an experimentalist. I think I showed you some data by Balzerini and Morrison. Remember that exquisite measurements along the coexistence curve, where they measured the density discontinuity over many decades. And the reason why they were doing this was to try to experimentally determine the corrections to scaling. And that paper, which is more recent, has references to later work than this. And as I recall, the conclusion of that paper was that the comparison of theory to experiment to theory was not totally satisfactory, but I don't know how to, we won't go there because I don't know what to say about that. Okay, so recall that the singular part of the free energy obeys this type of relation, fs of lambda to y sub t lambda to the y sub h equals lambda to the d s of t h. And that implies that the free energy, the singular part of the free energy, can be written in this scaling form, which we could write, for instance, as t to the 2 minus alpha g, some function of the scaling variable, which is h over t. We'll call it t to the delta, where in terms of this expression, 2 minus alpha was equal to d over y sub t. So in other words, this exponent, whatever it is related to these two exponents. And delta is equal to y sub H, I guess, over Y sub T, yes. Okay, that was the solution to this scaling form. And we showed that that is the solution. Now, this can be generalized. To the case where there are that you have more fields, possibly marginal or irrelevant. Coupling constants. By fields here, I mean coupling constants. So I'm just using the slang of the subject when I say fields. So basically, what we've done here is we've expressed the free energy completely in terms of these things that we control, T and H. The temperature in the magnetic field, and that's probably reasonable for magnetic systems and liquid gas transitions and stuff like that. But lurking in the background, there may be these other fields which we can't control, but we know from the renormalization group that when you start out with some Hamiltonian and you do the renormalization group transformation, you often generate other coupling constants, and they may actually be involved in the flow to the fixed point that is the one that controls the transition that you're interested in. We just had exactly this case, because the phase transition, say for the Ising model, if you believe that the Ising model is like this RU model, is controlled by that non-trivial fixed point. And there's some irrelevant operator which scales to zero at the non-trivial fixed point, which is nevertheless playing a role in the renormalization group flow. So that's what I mean when I say, and this, so this idea comes out of the renormalization group that there may be other operators which are maybe not the most important operators in the world, but they do affect the physics. And so let's then generalize the scaling relation. In a way that captures this. So the idea is that if you scale the temperature by some factor, and you scale the field by some factor, and then you've got these other coupling constants. Let's call this one Y1, G1, and you can imagine that there are others, where this Y1 might be less than Y. Okay. Might be negative, sorry. So that it might be a irrelevant operator, but nevertheless it's there, and that's equal to lambda to the d fs. So if this type of scaling correctly describes the effect on the free energy of this scaling. And imagine that this is marginal. Well, this guy's just going to zero in that case, in which case you're getting closer to what we talked about to start with. But in any case, if you have this scaling, then the free energy itself, the singular part, will obey the scaling form. We'll have the scaling form, THG1. is t to the 2 minus alpha for the usual reasons, fs of, wait, what did I call this? Let's call this g. Sorry. I hope this isn't going to mess up my notation. Maybe not. Probably won't do anything. Okay, so this looks just like it did before. And this is g1 over t to the delta 1, where delta is, as before, yh over yt. And delta 1 is y1 over yt.
So I'm a bit confused. So are you saying that if we apply that story to the Ising model, so n is 1, then there's a coupling constant that plays a role in phase transition but is not present in the original Hamiltonian?
Well, it is present in the original Hamiltonian. It's just that it's not something that you control.
So what are we
talking about? In other words, if your original Hamiltonian is some Ising-like Hamiltonian that you describe in terms of a U naught, and remember that's the one that gives you some distribution, so it's in that class of Hamiltonians with the U naught. You don't necessarily control what U naught is, but it's nevertheless, it will flow under renormalization. And it will give rise to an irrelevant, I mean, it's basically an irrelevant field. As we showed, because its eigenvalue is 1 minus epsilon log 2. Okay. So yeah. But it's not something, it's not, I mean, for a theoretician, it is a knob that you can turn. But for an experimentalist, it isn't. So why is it y1 over yt? It's the same, it's exactly the same reason as this is h over t to the yh over yt. It's when you do this scaling, this thing scales with lambda to the y1, and this thing scales with lambda to the yh to the y, sorry, lambda to the yt over yt over y1. Anyway, it all cancels exactly the same way as it did before. y1 over yt. Okay, so the argument that you use to get this just generalizes directly into this. So as I was hinting, an interesting irrelevant field is, say, you can write it as U naught minus U star, just like we wrote R T minus T C. Well, anyway. You can write it like that. And so then the question is, what is delta U, the exponent YU over YT? And that's just the ratio of this irrelevant exponent to this relevant exponent. And so this one here was the log of 1 minus epsilon log 2. And this one here is the log of 4 minus 4 thirds epsilon log 2. And without dragging you through the algebra, this turns out to be equal to minus epsilon over 2 plus where epsilon squared terms. So, if you look at this function then, you can see that as t goes to 0, then this whole thing is going to go to 0 because this delta is negative. Okay? So this thing basically vanishes. And so you should be able to expand the singular part of the free energy in an analytic series in this variable. Okay, because that one's just going to 0. And so so the point is that therefore so we can expand this free energy. So it's going to be basically t to the 2 minus alpha value when that's 0, plus there's going to be corrections going to start using this notation, which means that we're differentiating with respect to the second argument. Okay. I want to finish up quickly here. So let's just differentiate this with respect to H to calculate the magnetization. So you're going to get a t to the beta, which comes from that's 2 minus alpha minus delta. Believe that the m has to go like t to the beta for t less than tc. And then this is multiplying actually the 1, 0 derivative of fs evaluated 0, 0. Plus, you have something that looks like u naught minus u star t to the beta minus delta 1 f 1 1, you differentiate it. And so the point is that this is of the form times 1 times plus what, some constant times t to the minus delta 1. And minus delta 1 is epsilon over 2, which is a half in three dimensions. Okay. So the point is the following. If you look at what M looks like, it looks like this. And this is some X bar. If you look at this correction term here, this would be like T to the 1/2, say, square root of T. So it's like, actually, I should say, depending, this is very steep, it's not the square root of T. For a real Ising model with some fairly small exponent. But this function here is basically doing this. No, not that. Sorry. It's got some cuff-like behavior here, which is not as singular as this. This is a correction. A m t to the epsilon over 2, say. And of course, we don't look at this side. So if this thing, say for the 2D Ising model, is T minus TC of the 1/8, that gets multiplied by 1 plus something that goes like T minus TC to the 1/2. Okay? And you might say, so what? The 1/8 is very steep. You know, the square root might just look like a smooth background. But it isn't that smooth. Okay? And so this is what's called a confluent singularity. Okay, which means that it has non-analytic behavior at the same TC. It's not as dramatic as the actual leading behavior. It's a correction to it. It's an additive correction to it. But the problem is that if you want to analyze your data over a wide range around TC, it's actually important or useful to know what the leading order corrections are, especially if they're singular at the same point as the leading term that you're trying to extract from the data. So that's why people are interested, one reason why people are interested in corrections to scaling. Okay. There's another reason, which I won't bother to write down, but you can write the similar expressions for the specific heat and the susceptibility. And in every case, you get some coefficient out here, which is related to the magnetization or the susceptibility or the specific heat. And although these constants are not universal, their ratios can be universal. And so, in other words, they can be a property of the any model that corresponds to this fixed point. Okay, so sorry, I've run longer than I wanted to. At 1 o'clock, we have this meeting with Steve Gervin from Yale. I would really encourage you to come. He's a really inspiring scientist and a good person to meet. And he's going to talk a little bit about, cavity QED, what a meaning of a photon, which will be sort of linked to his colloquium. And we'll have to be in and out of here in like 45 minutes or less. So try to come at 1 o'clock for his presentation.